Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Many politicians and pundits are insisting that the United States Senate is broken, what used to be the body of Congress designed to allow passions to cool so that the 100 members from both parties could debate key issues, has dissolved into just another aspect of our politics, frozen by partisan bickering on issues over which there can be no debate, because to move even a millimeter is viewed as treachery, resulting in political suicide. In the Senate, one of the instruments of that gridlock is the filibuster. It's been around for a long time, but the way in which it is now being used and the frequency of its use has changed. Today, with slim control of the Senate, Democrats see the Republicans' use, or the potential use of the filibuster, roadblocking any Democratic legislation or policies, while Republicans view it as a smart way to bring any legislation to a dead stop. They see the filibuster as a kill switch. Is this what the founders had in mind? And what would happen if some Democrats had their way and limited its use altogether or ended it forever? Adam Gentleson joins us on this Politics Monday to flesh that out. He is former Deputy Chief of Staff to former Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and now the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Adam Gentleson is also the Executive Director of the Battleborn Collective, a progressive organization advocating for the end of the filibuster, among other things. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, the filibuster, I remember the filibuster being talked about when I was a kid. Didn't know what it was. Still not sure what it exactly is, but it's been around for a long time, and it's been used by both political parties. When and why did it start?
Well, that's a complicated question, and to answer it, I sort of will have to take a quick walk through about 200 years of history, but I will try to do it as quickly as I can. I mean, I think the most important thing that I would like your listeners to understand is that it was not supposed to be part of the Senate in the first place, and it was not part of the original Senate. And there was a very clear reason for this. The framers invented the Senate as a majority rule institution. They had seen what happens when you put any sort of supermajority threshold. And when I say supermajority, I mean, you know, a rule requiring anything more than a majority to pass a certain piece of legislation. The Articles of Confederation, which of course was the first draft of American government, had a supermajority rule in its version of Congress. The framers put it there with the same intent that defenders of the filibuster argue the filibuster serves today, you know, to promote compromise and consensus. But instead, in the Articles of Confederation, the supermajority threshold created gridlock and made it very easy for the minority on any given issue, if they didn't like what the majority was doing, to simply grind the whole system to a halt. So when the framers wrote the Constitution, they were very clear that they did not want this to happen again. On the one hand, they wanted to create a system of checks and balances, and they wanted the Senate to play a thoughtful and deliberative role in contrast to the sort of rough and tumble House. But they also wanted the majority to be able to move legislation along. They wanted the public business to be able to go forward, as they put it in the Federalist Papers. So they created these checks and balances, but they wanted every decision point within that system to be majority rule. So this is how the Senate operated for about the first half century of its existence. The filibuster didn't really start to come into existence in any systematic way until around the 1830s. Its lead progenitor at this time was a guy named John Calhoun, a senator from South Carolina, who was the leading advocate of the slave power in Congress. And he wanted to expand the power of the minority in the Senate to block what the majority wanted to do. He was very explicit about this. James Madison, sort of the chief defender of minority rights among the framers, actually lived long enough to see Calhoun start to do some of what he was doing. And in the early 1830s, people wrote to Madison and they said, "What do you think about what this guy John Calhoun is doing? He sort of invokes your concern for the rights of minorities in what he's putting out there." And Madison made very clear that he thought Calhoun was taking Madison's conception of protecting the rights of the minorities far beyond what Madison ever intended. The way Calhoun saw it, Madison provided enough protections for a minority faction to have a voice in the system, but Calhoun thought that wasn't enough. He wanted the minority to be able to wield a veto over what the majority wanted to do, and he was explicit about this in his writings. So he innovates what we would think of as the talking filibuster. This is the sort of Jimmy Stewart style, going to the floor, using the floor to delay a piece of legislation. But that is what exists throughout the 19th century, and that was not strong enough to actually block legislation. The best you could do was delay it. The Senate continued to be a majority rule body through the 19th century and into the 20th. In the 20th century, senators, primarily Southern senators, who were self-avowed white supremacists, I don't use that term lightly, but this is how they described themselves, sought to block a series of civil rights bills that were coming before the Congress at the time. And so they took the talking filibuster that Calhoun had sort of been the lead inventor of and started to use it to force a supermajority threshold, similar to what we see today. But they only applied the supermajority threshold to civil rights bills. One thing I want to be real clear about is that, we think sometimes that the filibuster served a purpose, maybe a cooling saucer type thing where America wasn't ready for action on civil rights. But during this period, it was very clear that America was ready for action on civil rights. There were bills passing the House by wide margins. They had broad public support. Anti-lynching bills, Gallup found at the time in the 1930s, had upwards of 72% support among the American people. Anti-poll tax bills had upwards of 60%. So these bills would have passed into law if the senators had not found a way to block them, and that is how they innovated the use of the supermajority threshold, forcing civil rights bills, and only civil rights bills, to clear this higher standard of a supermajority, and using that to successfully block them for nearly 100 years until 1964.
What I'm hearing you say is that conservatives have been the progenitors of this and the primary users of it, but that's not necessarily the case. Progressives have also used the filibuster. Democrats and Republicans have used it. Is their use of it different in any way, or is it simply the issues? Is the intent always to delay or stop legislation that they don't like?
The intent is always to delay or stop. And when progressives use it, and you're right, they have used it too. One of the most famous filibusters in American history was in 1917, when a progressive anti-war senator named Fighting Bob La Follette of Wisconsin used the filibuster to block a bill that was being advanced by Woodrow Wilson with the intent of arming American merchant ships in the entry to World War I. And this was actually a filibuster that led to a major change in Senate rules and caused a national backlash against the Senate for being obstructionist. It's the same intent. I mean, La Follette used it to block this bill that he opposed. But over history, you see that there is overwhelmingly more utility in the filibuster for conservatives, whether they were Republicans or Democrats. During the first half of the century, the most conservative members of Congress and the most segregationist were members of the Democratic Party primarily. And they, so both sides of the ideological spectrum, regardless of party, have found it useful to serve their purposes. But the basic truth is that this is a tool that makes it easier to block things, to stop action. And by its very nature, it therefore benefits the side of the spectrum that is more interested in blocking change and preserving the status quo. So whether it's Republicans or Democrats, that is the conservative side of the spectrum. And William F. Buckley's famous phrase, conservatives are those who stand athwart history yelling stop. So even though it has been used by both sides occasionally and has certainly served liberals' purpose in some high-profile ways throughout history, its net benefit is definitely to the side of the spectrum that wants to stop action versus the side that wants to create progressive change.
We're going to talk a lot about the filibuster as we go through this hour, because that's what your book is about. But you also say that the Senate has been in a state of steady decline as the decentralized, open, and relatively obstruction-free institution the framers created was transformed into something altogether unrecognizable. You call it now a soul-crushing bureaucracy as opposed to a great deliberative body. It has become a place, you say, where orders are handed down as opposed to where deliberations take place. How did that happen? Why would senators, all 100 of them, are equals, allow this to happen, allow themselves to just be people who come to Washington to take orders from, I guess, the Senate Majority Leader?
It's about 200 years of backsliding. there was never a conscious decision to make it this way. But steadily, over the course of 200 years, there was just one decision after another, several of which had unintended consequences that were aimed at trying to reform the Senate and make it work better, that instead had the opposite effect. And that's how we got to where we are. And that combined with forces outside the Senate's control, like the rising polarization in American politics, the flood of dark money that was unleashed by some Supreme Court decisions recently, and the Senate's inability to pass any legislation to stop or fix these things, and certainly it's not blameless in creating these conditions. But you know, we as a nation have moved into a more polarized state of affairs that is true not just in politics, but in our personal lives, in the neighborhoods we choose to live in the places we choose to shop, even in the shows we watch. There have been many sociological studies that show this to be the case. So, you know, it was a steady decline. And I think what you saw as a sort of consistent dynamic throughout this period that led to this decline was that the asymmetry of the filibuster allowed those who wanted to stop change to wield more power than those who wanted to change it. Because this was not a decline that happened to the surprise of those in the Senate. Many people in the Senate, some leading lights of the Senate, from Henry Clay to Nelson Aldrich to Henry Cabot Lodge, saw what was happening and were very vocal about the fact that they wanted it to stop. When the filibuster first came into existence in the 1830s, Henry Clay rose up and immediately tried to get rid of it because he sort of foresaw how damaging it was going to be to the institution. And he was outmaneuvered because it's very hard to, it's easy to wield the filibuster. You only need a small group to do it, but it's very hard to change it because you need to get a bigger, broader coalition to enact reform.
This
So this
idea of
asymmetry has always served the obstructionists and has been what sort of led it to this steady decline over basically 200 years.
This idea that the senators are simply taking their marching orders from someone on high, from a single central location within the United States Senate, it seems to be in diametric opposition to what the Senate claims to be, which is the world's most deliberative body. And I'm curious, if C-SPAN had existed in the 1800s or the early 1900s, for that matter, if we tuned in then, as opposed to today, would we have seen more robust debate? Are you saying that control from a central location has cut off debate? There's no reason to have debate because everybody knows how they're going to vote already?
100%.
Wow.
The Senate used to be, so, you know, just I think if the framers could time warp or drop down, you know, and see what the Senate looked like today, it would be unrecognizable as we're discussing. If they could look at the House, they would say, okay, yeah, that basically looks like what we thought it would look like. The Senate is the one of the two chambers that has veered dramatically from the way the framers intended it to be. In the early days, yes, you had every senator sat on the floor for beginners, for starters. You know, right now you have these gigantic, if you go to Capitol Hill, you will see surrounding the Capitol these gigantic office buildings where senators have their offices and spend most of their time. Each senator has a relatively large office with a suite of smaller offices for their staff. Back in the day, those office buildings didn't exist. There were no professional staff. And when senators came to work, they simply went to their desk on the Senate floor, and that was their workspace. They didn't have any staff, and they would sit there on the floor all day together, debating whatever bill was on the floor and deciding what to do as a body. The vice president, who continues to be the president of the Senate, that's set by the Constitution, would preside over the Senate basically every day during the early days. And so there were bodies on the floor. They were talking, they were engaging, they were having a thoughtful conversation. And you know, you could sit in the gallery and watch this take place. Right now, if you turn into C-SPAN 2 and look at the Senate, you will see most likely an empty floor. Maybe there's one senator giving a speech, but if they are giving a speech, they're probably reading it from a piece of paper handed to them by their staff. They are very likely seeing these words for the first time as they read them into the record. There may be a few staff milling about in the back. There are probably more staff than senators on the floor. That's usually the case. And if there are other senators in the chamber, they're probably not listening to the one who's speaking. And the reason for this is that they're all waiting around to get their marching orders from the leaders. And that is one thing that has become very different, is that top-down partisan structure that we have today.
Wow. More to talk about. A ton of stuff to talk about as a result of that. Adam Gentleson is our guest. Kill Switch is the book. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Adam Gentleson is our guest, former Deputy Chief of Staff to the former Democratic House Majority Leader Harry Reid. He's written a book called Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. It centers on a lot of things, but the filibuster is the chief problem here. But you also say that the Senate's decline was set in motion by senators who found that suffocating the institution with genteel gridlock served their interests. You mentioned desires, and this dates back to Jim Crow, to protect slavery, to protect the Jim Crow era, to white supremacy, to protect white supremacy. Is that the basic drive even operating today, or is it broader than that?
Well, there's no doubt that protecting white supremacy was the leading drive behind the rise of gridlock. And it was certainly John Calhoun's motivation in the 1830s. I think there's a little bit of a gray area when it comes to the founding of the filibuster. It was used for other purposes in its very inception, but any ambiguity about its primary purpose fell away in the early 20th century, where it was being explicitly used as a tool for the maintenance of white supremacy. And again, I don't use these terms lightly. I think it's important to be rigorous about this. But when you go back and look at the history, there was no shyness among the senators themselves about declaring that this was their intent. Senator Richard Russell of Georgia was the leading innovator and protector of the filibuster throughout this period. He came to the Senate in the 1930s and was there all the way up into the 1970s. He was the leader of the Southern Bloc, the recognized leader of the Senate as a whole in many ways. The position of majority leaders was relatively weak until Lyndon Johnson took over, and he was Lyndon Johnson's mentor and gave him his power. But Richard Russell said, and I quote, any Southern man worth a pinch of salt would give his all to protect white supremacy. In 1949, there was a Rules Committee hearing evaluating the use of the filibuster, and Russell testified at that hearing and declared that his primary purpose in defending and wanting to preserve the filibuster was to block civil rights bills. So, you know, these were popular stances for these senators back home. I mean, this was a different era, and so they were not shy about declaring this to be their intent. So there's no question that that is what led to the strengthening of the filibuster during this period and many steps that were taken at this time to protect and preserve it today. When you look at today, I think it's a more complex picture. I think that one thing that is for certain is that it protects the entrenched power of the status quo. It protects the 1%. When we talk about protecting minority factions in the Senate, we are usually talking, when it comes to the filibuster, about powerful minorities, about the 1% versus the 99%, and things like that. So I think it's a more complex picture, but I think that it is certainly the single most powerful tool in our government to stop the march of the type of progressive and small d democratic change that has led to the expansion of rights and to the expansion of the social safety net, and that march of progressive change throughout history.
You write that over time, those who have used the filibuster figured out how to, quote, raise the threshold for passing bills in the Senate from a simple majority, as the framers had intended, to the supermajority that has become standard in the modern Senate. How did the concept of this supermajority, I know you mentioned the fact that it was in the Articles of Confederation and the founders realized, well, that doesn't work, so they took it out of the Constitution and didn't put it in the section of the Constitution about the Congress, but How did that develop later, the idea of a need for a supermajority?
Right. Yes, that's right. So this was, you know, this was a hot topic at the Constitutional Convention. This was something the framers considered and rejected. They specified a small number of things that they thought should require a supermajority, extraordinary things like removal from office, an impeachment, or amending the Constitution. But everything else they said, you know, majority rule. And there was a rule in the original Senate that said, when a debate was going on for too long, a majority of the Senate could vote to cut it off. They got rid of that rule by mistake as the Senate was cleaning up its rule books in the early 1800s because no one ever used it. The Senate, as I said before, for the first half century of its existence, operated without any major obstruction. So nobody thought this rule was necessary at the time. What happened as it went into this period of decline in the late 19th century and early 20th century was that obstruction rose and they started to realize that they did need a tool to cut off debate when it became obstructive. And so they sort of reached back to this rule that had been on the books originally and tried to recreate it in 1917. And this is Rule 22, which today is what empowers the filibuster in the Senate. they created what they called cloture, which is better understood as closure. It's a rule that allows a certain number of senators to vote to bring closure to a debate after it had gone on for too long. But the committee that developed this rule in 1917 couldn't quite come to an agreement to set it at a majority threshold where it had been in the original Senate rules. And so they agreed to set it at a supermajority threshold. At the time, it was 2/3. And the idea there was that in a period where obstruction was still relatively rare but rising, they thought that when it became clear that a debate had veered from an attempt at persuasion into an attempt at outright obstruction, there would always be a supermajority of senators who were willing to come together and say, all right, that's enough, guys. Cut it off. Let's move this bill to a vote. And so they said a supermajority threshold is reasonable. But what happened was these white supremacist Southern senators of the time, seeking to uphold Jim Crow, started to apply that threshold to every civil rights bill. And civil rights gave them the motivation and reason to force these bills to clear a supermajority threshold. Southerners at this time, it should also be noted, were extremely powerful. The Southern bloc in the Senate was the most powerful bloc. They controlled all of the important committees. And so if the Southern senators were telling you, you don't want to mess with us, don't cross us on this vote, don't help the Senate reach a supermajority threshold to clear the civil rights bill, it was a bad career move for you as a senator to cross them, even if you supported civil rights, because they held your career in their hands. They could deny you spots on all of the committees that were critical to advancing your career. They could make sure your legislation never came to the floor. They could make you completely ineffective as a senator. So it was during this period in the early 20th century that the supermajority threshold that I discuss in the book started to come into existence. But it was only applied to civil rights. Civil rights were the only bill that consistently faced a supermajority threshold and failed to clear it. I just want to dwell on that for 1 second, because, you know, we think of this period and stretching into the post-war period as sort of when we built the middle class and built modern America. And every bill that we passed during this period to build America and to build the middle class cleared the Senate on a simple majority basis. The only test for it was whether it could achieve a majority. The only bills that had to clear a supermajority threshold during this period were civil rights, and so those were the only bills that were consistently blocked.
So did the people putting the supermajority requirement into place know of the history of this? Did they know that the founders had put it in the Articles of Confederation, discovered that it didn't work, and took it out of the Constitution? Just a simple yes or no. Did they know, or was this just out of ignorance?
Yeah, they knew. They knew exactly what they were doing.
So given that, it seems to me that a lot of the people who claim to be strict constructionists of the Constitution and want to toe the line to make sure everything we do is exactly what the framers intended are being hypocritical about this.
That's 100% right. You know, I mean, I think one of the things they try to say, I'm going to try to give their best defense here, is that, you know, this reflects a shift in wisdom. It's funny, they make the argument that progressives would make when it comes to interpreting the Constitution, that, you know, what we should take into account is how things have changed over the last 200 years. But what I try to show in the book is that throughout this period, as the Senate entered this decline, there were many voices in the Senate saying, don't do this, you know, reform the filibuster, don't let this come into place. This is bad for the institution and is bad for the country because it is imposing gridlock where there should be an effective government that takes time to consider legislation thoughtfully, but at the end of the day, allows it to come up for a simple majority vote, pass or fail. This is the basic principle underlying most of our democratic system.
It is said that because of the filibuster, bills that might easily pass never even get a vote. They fail on procedural motions. Why? Just because the threat exists that if you put this on the floor, we're going to filibuster it?
Yes, that's right.
Why is that a threat?
Well, because if you're the majority leader and you know that this bill is going to get filibustered and doesn't have 60 votes, you may not bring it to the floor at all. Time is a zero-sum resource.
It isn't just a filibuster. It's the fact that you need 60 votes. You need a supermajority to pass it. That's the threat, right?
That's right. And this is not 60 votes to pass, right? Even today, the number of votes it takes to pass a bill in the Senate is still technically a majority reflecting what the framers intended. It's the procedural hurdle to end debate that is 60 votes, and that is what most bills fail to clear.
It seems insane to me.
Don't disagree.
It just does. Okay, so why are some Democrats not in favor, since they hold the cards right now by one vote, the vice president's vote, why are they not in favor, all of them, of killing off either the supermajority or the filibuster or both?
So there are some enduring myths that give the filibuster life even today. And one of those is the idea that it promotes bipartisanship. And I think you have senators like Joe Manchin who are centrists, who are very interested in pursuing bipartisanship for its own sake. And they still believe that the filibuster helps foster this. And, you know, the case for that is intuitive. You need 60 votes, right? And in a Senate that is evenly divided as it is today, 50 and 50 Democrats and Republicans, obviously, to get to 60, you need some senators of the other side to come over. So he thinks keeping this requirement, you know, sort of holding themselves to a higher standard will help promote bipartisanship. The problem is that in our polarized era, you can't get to 60 on virtually anything that President Biden wants to do. You could actually see a lot of situations where you could get to 52 or 53, where Democrats could pick up some Republican senators like a Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski or Mitt Romney. And in that way, the filibuster is preventing bipartisanship. But I think it's that enduring myth that makes senators like Manchin committed to preserving it, although I think his stances tend to evolve over time, and so we'll see what happens there.
There's no way to tell positively, I suppose. Maybe there is, historically, to look at this and say, in the absence of the filibuster, in the absence of the supermajority, that things would, in fact, be more bipartisan. I'm sure that you think they would. Do you have any historical precedent to indicate that you are correct?
Yes, I do. I mean, one of the historical precedents is simply the way the Senate existed for most of its lifetime. Everything that passed or failed, aside from civil rights, all the way up through the mid-1960s, passed or failed on a majority rule basis. And what you consistently saw during this time was a dynamic where bills would be hard fought until they proved that they could secure a majority. You know, this idea of obstruction isn't a new idea in American politics. The tools are simply stronger today to implement it. But, you know, the side that was out of power would always fight the side that was in power and try to stop whatever they were doing. But once they saw that the side in power that was advocating for a certain bill could pass it with a majority, then the dynamic would quickly shift. And a lot of senators from the other side would come on board and say, well, okay, if this thing is going to pass and it's going to be popular, I want a piece of it. A good example of this is Medicare. You know, we see this as a major bipartisan accomplishment, but it was fought tooth and nail by its opponents until it could secure a majority. There's a memo from LBJ's top legislative aide, a guy named Mike Manatos, writing to the president, celebrating the fact that he now could assure the president that that Medicare would pass because he could identify a majority of votes in the Senate in support of it. Once that majority was in place, a bunch of other senators jumped on board and said, I want to get on this bill and get credit for it. And that ran the vote total up to 70, a healthy bipartisan total. But it was fought tooth and nail before you could get to a majority. So one of the dynamics we see is, you know, once you get to a majority, other senators, their incentive structure shifts and they say, well, I can't stop this thing anymore. Maybe I actually want to get a piece of this popular legislation. You look at something like Biden's American Rescue Plan, and you had some senators like Lisa Murkowski saying, well, maybe I should have voted for this because it's still polling at 75%.
Although he hasn't been in the news recently, Grover Norquist, the Republican strategist, is famous for saying that he'd like to shrink government so that it fits into a teacup, and he wants to cut taxes to make sure that they can't do anything, because without revenues, you can't do very much. And that's what Republicans have been running on. Let's keep it out of your business. Let's just do what we have to do to get by. But what we have here with the filibuster and the supermajority, it seems to me, is that a lot of members of Congress, the minority in Congress, is controlling the majority in Congress, and that's going against the will of the people who put the majority in Congress in charge. Would that be accurate?
That's 100% accurate. And that's one of the things that is sort of a myth about the filibuster, is the idea that if you get rid of it, you're going to see people ramming through legislation that is narrowly supported. The fact of the matter is the system that the framers designed has a lot of checks and balances. And without the filibuster, those checks and balances exert a moderating influence on legislation. It's still hard to get majority support in the House, majority support in the Senate, have a president ready to sign it, and have legislation that is upheld by the judiciary. So, you know, what you're seeing is not legislation get blocked, you know, that are things like Medicare for All that are far left priorities. in a majority rule Senate, that wouldn't be able to pass because it could probably get, maybe 15 votes in the Senate. What you're seeing get blocked are pieces of legislation that have broad bipartisan support out there in the real world among Americans. Legislation I talk about in the book, one formative experience for me was watching a background checks bill get blocked in the wake of the Newtown shooting that happened in 2012. This was a bill that literally had 88% support of the American people. It had support of a bipartisan group of senators, 55 senators. It had the support of many gun rights groups, not the NRA, but some other gun rights groups. This was a piece of legislation that was not a far left priority. It was a very reasonable, pragmatic, centrist priority that had extremely broad public support, and it failed because it couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate.
How much of that is to do with the supermajority, the need for that, and the threat of the filibuster versus our primary system, during which senators and other people running for federal office have got to play to the base, or they get primaried and they don't get to come back to Washington because they don't get into the general election?
That has caused the filibuster to be what it is today, or at least I think it's one of the major factors. In a previous era where polarization was less severe and partisanship was less severe, the 60-vote threshold could conceivably serve a useful purpose. If people were free to sort of pursue the legislation that they believed in and pursue their principles and have less incentive to hew directly to the furthest side of their party's polarized party line, you could see them sort of using this filibuster productively. What you have today instead is a system where people feel a strong incentive to go as far to the right or left as they can. Political scientists have studied this, and you see that 60th vote, right, the tipping point vote in a supermajority system, that 60th vote has moved farther out to either side of the spectrum. It used to be relatively close to the center, and now it's much farther to the extreme side of either pole. When that happens, it makes it harder to achieve. And so I think the increased polarization and the increased incentives for all senators to follow the most extreme elements of their party has made it harder to get to 60. And in that situation, that's where I argue, look, the highest order principle here is for the Senate to actually function. It's not going to single-handedly alleviate the polarized system that we have today. The best we can expect of it is to actually function and pass bills that have these broad bipartisan support so that we can have a functioning system again.
Filibusters have been defeated. LBJ defeated the filibuster, one set by his own mentor, I think George's Richard Russell, over the civil rights bill that was passed. If the filibuster can be defeated, isn't that an argument for keeping it?
It would be, except I think it's important to look at what extreme circumstances it required to defeat that 1964 filibuster. And then I think it becomes an argument in the other direction that shows how extraordinary the effort is required to defeat a filibuster. So first off, 1964 was 87 years after the end of Reconstruction. And during that 87-year period, civil rights bills had been blocked consistently by the Senate filibuster. So already, you've caused a massive delay. Then to defeat that filibuster, it took LBJ working with the Democratic Senate leader and the Republican Senate leader, and it took them 2 months to break this filibuster. So that's a lot of effort.
You need LBJ's superhuman political power to achieve something like that, I guess. Adam Gentleson is our guest. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Adam Gentleson is the former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid, the former majority leader in the Senate, the Democrat. He's also the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy, which is what we're talking about right now. And to get back to that title and also to something we were talking about a moment ago, Barry emails, how can we get the moderate majority to turn out for the primaries? If senators knew that moderates who want compromise would vote in primaries, senators would be far less likely to use the filibuster, since almost nobody votes in the primaries. A senator who wants to remain in office has to appeal to the extremists who do turn out before the general election. And polls find repeatedly that there is bipartisan consensus on everything from gun control to voting rights, but legislation on such issues is inevitably killed by the filibuster. It seems like citizens' views aren't being accurately represented.
I 100% agree with that. I think one thing you can do is to make it easier to vote in this country. I think that, one of the things we've seen in recent years is a wave of voter suppression that nonpartisan experts have said is the most extreme since Jim Crow. And I think it's essential that we make it, as easy as possible, obviously, within certain boundaries of reasonability here. But I think that voting should be, people should be automatically registered to vote when you get your driver's license. Voting should be a holiday. We should make it easier for folks who can't afford to take time off and things like that. So I think that making it easier to vote has been shown to increase turnout. And I think that is an important step we can take. I think that the problem for extreme primaries, it is certainly a problem on the Democratic side, but it really is shown to be a more extreme problem on the Republican side. That is where you have seen things like we saw in Alabama in 2017, where man who had been credibly accused of child molestation won the Republican primary. Trump still seems to hold a very tight grip on his party, has said he's going to work against moderate Republicans in the upcoming wave of Republican primaries, like Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. He is targeted as someone he wants to unseat. So even Senator Mitch McConnell apparently is not far right enough for former President Trump. So it's certainly a factor on the Democratic side as well. But I think that right now you have a Republican Party that is really spinning off into unseen areas of radicalization that I think is a very dangerous dynamic that's going to continue, unfortunately.
You say that, and it's true, that the framers of the Constitution intended for the Senate to be this cooling off saucer, so to speak, where although the passions of the House were on full display, the legislation would move to the Senate and things would calm down as they deliberated and talked about the pros and cons, which they don't do anymore. But the filibuster still exists, and that slows things down. Could it be argued that that's playing into what the founders intended the function of the Senate to be?
You could argue that, and that is certainly what its defenders would say. They would say that in our polarized era, you need sort of a stricter rule to try to force this consensus, and you can't rely on people to sort of do it out of the goodness of their heart. But I think that what's important to keep in mind is that is conceivable, but I think the balance has tilted dramatically towards obstruction. If this were the case, you would see bills actually come to the floor and you would see them debated. And I think the thing that gives the lie to this theory is that the people who are advocating for the filibuster as a means of continuing debate and thoughtful consideration of the issue don't actually use the time to debate. They just use the supermajority threshold to kill the bill.
Which also brings us to this: the nature of the filibuster has changed. Because in the old days, when you had a filibuster, you stood on the Senate floor and you talked until you fell.
That's right.
You talked until you couldn't talk anymore. You would read Dr. Seuss, or you would read the Bible, or you would read something just to keep talking, to stop debate. Now, that doesn't have to happen. Why not? If you're going to have a filibuster, why don't they have to stand up there and talk for 48 hours, 72 hours?
The answer is it's a very interesting study in unintended consequences. In the 1970s and 80s, Senate leaders were faced with a huge management challenge, which was the size of government was growing, and they simply had a lot of work to schedule on the Senate floor. And so they basically passed a series of rule changes that made it easier for them to find out if a bill was going to be filibustered ahead of time. And then if it was going to be filibustered ahead of time, they would not bring it to the floor. And so there, over two or three decades, there acquired this deference to the idea that a threat of a filibuster was equal to an actual filibuster. So if a senator simply signaled that they intended to filibuster, that automatically raised the number of votes that it took to pass a bill to 60, which was the number you used to have to cut off a filibuster. And today, that has sort of had a downward spiral into the point where that threat of a filibuster can be lodged simply by sending an email. So any single senator can automatically raise the number of votes it takes to pass a bill just by having their staff send an email. And that is why it happens on virtually everything that comes before the Senate today.
Ending
and they never have to go to the floor. They never have to debate the bill. Right. They never have to say anything in public. They just send that email. So that is why, this idea of the purpose that it's supposed to serve has become completely divorced in the reality of how this filibuster functions today.
So ending the filibuster has been referred to by many as the nuclear option. Why?
So this is a somewhat hyperbolic term that came into use around the beginning of the 21st century at a time when actually Republicans were seeking to end the filibuster under President George W. Bush. William Safire, the New York Times columnist, coined the phrase. Trent Lott, who was a Senate leader at the time, is also credited with coming up with it. The idea is that it's a dramatic step to vote on a majority rule basis to end the filibuster. But I think it's not as dramatic as it seems. This is something that has been done several dozen times throughout the Senate's history. It is hyped up as a extreme move by those who don't want it to happen, but it is actually consistent with the Senate's history to change its rules. The Senate was meant to be an evolving body. It was supposed to be an institution that could evolve and change and adapt, as any institution needs to do if it's going to avoid becoming obsolete. So there's Senate precedent. There's several dozen instances of it doing this. It has been used by my former boss, Senator Harry Reid, and it has been used by Senator Mitch McConnell. So, you know, everybody who opposes it tries to make it seem extreme, but actually it's perfectly consistent with the Senate's history, and there's ample precedent for it.
If Democrats want to get rid of the supermajority or the filibuster, they have to be proactive. They have to go on the offensive. And you believe that politicians should go on, particularly Democrats, should go on the offensive. Democrats seem to have a tough time with this. I heard somebody just yesterday on one of the Sunday shows say that Democrats are always afraid of what might happen if they do something, and Republicans are not. They just do it. So how do you convince Democrats to, how can I put this politely, to have the courage of their conviction? There we go.
Well, look, I feel pretty good about where we are right now as someone who advocates for reform because, you know, yes, Senators Manchin and Sinema are being somewhat dug in their positions, but in a way, it's a good problem to have that we're sort of down to only two senators at this point. And, you know, getting the last two votes on any major piece of legislation is always very difficult. I look back at 2013 when we did reform the rules and we were way behind the pace that we are at now. So I'm somewhat encouraged. And you're right. I think Democrats live in fear of what the other side is going to do. But I think, you know, and they say getting rid of the filibuster is risky for that reason. But I think I would argue that the riskiest thing to do is to, so, you know, by not getting rid of the filibuster, we are incurring an enormous cost. We are refusing to pass things like H.R. 1, voting rights bills, gun control, many climate change policies that won't be able to be done through any other means. So we're incurring that cost in the hopes that this defensive tool, the filibuster, will be available for us in the future when we want to use it. The problem with that calculation is that Mitch McConnell can get rid of it at any time that he wants, and he likely will get rid of it the first time it serves his interests.
Right.
So
right.
The riskiest option is to do nothing, incur this massive cost, and then let Mitch McConnell get rid of it later.
So what would it take? What would it take to do it? To get rid of it?
The good news is that all it takes, and it can happen at any time, is a majority of the senators to vote to get rid of it, to change the rule, and how they change
it. A simple majority.
For debate. A simple majority. And so Democrats have 50
votes. Would that mean 50 votes, and the vice president breaks the tie? That would work?
That's right. Yep, that would work.
Why don't they do it?
Because we are not quite there on the vote count. You've got Senators Manchin and Sinema who are hesitant. And I think what's going to happen, though, is, you know, we're going to see in the future coming weeks and months a record of obstruction start to be built up where Republicans are going to start blocking key aspects of President Biden's agenda. We haven't seen that yet. They were able to pass the American Rescue Plan through reconciliation process, which is an end run around the filibuster, which without getting into the weeds can be used for some things, but not that many things.
Right.
So, you know, we're sort of exhausting the uses of reconciliation pretty quickly here. But things like voting rights, gun control, all those things have to be done through the regular order, which means they can be blocked by the filibuster. As those things get blocked, I think pressure is going to mount on Senators Manchin and Sinema to take action.
We have about 6 minutes left. I've got a lot of territory that I want to cover, but you just brought up something that we got the Recovery Act passed through reconciliation, and that happened at the permission of the parliamentarian. This is something I've never heard mentioned in my entire life before. Maybe because you worked in Congress, you have heard it. When did the parliamentarian become the boss?
Yeah, well, technically, they're not even the boss. They issue an advisory opinion, and it is senators' decision to follow it. This is just sort of a norm that has evolved. This gets back to the rise of professional staff that I sort of alluded to before, where, you know, senators used to, there didn't used to be a parliamentarian. They used to be their own parliamentarians. But, you know, it has evolved in sort of a professionalized system where senators have become very reliant on professional staff. That's true in their personal offices where they have, you know, staff who are experts on every issue under the sun. They're reliant on their advice. And on procedural matters, they've come to default to the norm of allowing the parliamentarian, who is a staff person who's appointed by the majority leader, to issue a ruling. And that's a choice they've made to sort of set that norm of relying on professional staff.
You wrote an article for The Atlantic in which you called what we've been talking about the minority rule doom loop. But this is more than what we've been talking about. It actually consists of four interlocking components. Talk about that.
That's right. So, you know, people talk about threats to democracy. And what I think is the single biggest threat to our democracy today is not the risk of rules changes in the Senate, which are entirely within the ability of the Senate to do, and there's ample precedent for them doing it. I think the biggest risk to our democracy is for the government to continue diverging in its agenda from the will of the majority of its people. I think that is an untenable dynamic in any democracy as the governed start to feel like the government doesn't represent them. We see that consistently on issues where vast majorities of the public support a position, but the government is unable to pass it. The doom loop is that as we have become partisan, and as we have become sorted, a minority of predominantly white conservatives have developed the ability to exploit anti-democratic features of our government that have always existed, but have never really served one party over the other. They've developed the ability to exploit those features to exert their will over the majority of the country on a consistent basis. It helps them get elected. Republicans have an easier time getting elected because of voter suppression. Once they're elected, they have an easier time acquiring control of the Senate and the White House because of the Electoral College, which benefits them, and because of the Senate's structure that makes it easier for people who represent predominantly rural white states to gain power. And then if they're ever kicked out of power, they have the minority veto in the Senate to stop what the majority wants to do. So this is an unhealthy loop that causes our government not to represent the people who live in this country. And I think that's a very dangerous dynamic.
And that is why you say that this, how Democrats and President Biden deal with this in the next couple of months will determine the fate of our democracy. Those sound really serious, those words. And it's breaking this loop, you say, is only possible if President Biden treats this like the crisis that it is, from what you know of President Biden, who likes to think of himself as somebody who can deal with Republicans on a man-to-man basis or a man-to-woman basis, is he likely to view it as a crisis?
I think that he is. I'm encouraged by what I've heard from President Biden so far. In remarks very recently, he said that his primary goal is to get things done. And I think that's where we need to get back to. I think that we've become too wrapped up in these myths about the Senate and what it is and the purpose it's supposed to serve. Many of these myths have been put in place, as we've discussed, for the explicit purpose of maintaining white supremacy. We need to get back to basic principles here. The Senate exists to pass thoughtful legislation that is responsive to the crises that America faces and responsive to public opinion in a more deliberative way than the House. But nonetheless, the public business is supposed to go forward, as the framers emphasized again and again in the Federalist Papers. I think from what we've seen with President Biden so far, he is very tuned in to this as his primary goal. He wants to deliver results. He wants to follow through on the things he promised the American people. And I think that includes creating a system that is more healthy in how we elect people and a more level playing field for our democracy.
You spoke a minute ago about the ability of Republicans to take charge once they're in the Senate, and even though they represent a minority of people in the country. And that brings us to something that you've talked about and that Bill Maher consistently talks about. He uses the Dakotas as an example of states, two states combined that have a tiny population, but they have four senators, as opposed to California, which has an enormous population and has two senators. You have used Wyoming as an example, a state of about 600,000 people, which is smaller than the District of Columbia. And giving the District of Columbia statehood would help to equalize that, as would giving the territory of Puerto Rico statehood. What's the likelihood of that happening? The Republicans know that that would strengthen the Democrats' hold a little teeny tiny bit, not much, but enough to make a difference in some cases.
That's right. It's definitely not going to happen as long as the filibuster remains in place. Republicans will not vote for either of those changes. But if we get rid of the filibuster, or at least reform it significantly, I think that it is quite likely that these things happen. And I do think this is necessary. As you said, you know, Wyoming is 600,000 people, predominantly white. They get two senators. D.C. is 600,000 people, predominantly black and brown, and they get no senators. So if we want to rectify this imbalance of our system where white people in rural areas are overrepresented in the Senate and have more power than people living in urban areas, we have to pass these reforms. Puerto Rico, if it became a state, would be larger than 20 states in this country. And currently, both these areas are living under taxation without representation. This is a basic principle that led to the founding of the country. It's injustice, and it needs to be fixed.
How difficult was it to bring Alaska and Hawaii into statehood back in the late 50s?
Yeah, you know, I mean, back then, these things happened more frequently. There were constitutional amendments that passed on a more frequent basis. I think those states were difficult. But, you know, you look at how states were brought into the country, it's always been a question of the balance of power. Obviously, this was, you know, a huge issue in the lead up to the Civil War. So it would not be the first time that states were brought into the country, into the nation, in order to rectify an imbalance of power that the majority was opposed to and was supported by a minority.
Adam Gentleson, we've just scratched the surface of what he writes about in his book, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. But that is why the book exists, so that you can learn more from the former Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Harry Reid. Interesting hour. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.